Like, technically, they don't really fit me. I actually have a really narrow instep. Yeah, it's the only podcast I can discuss this on. I have a very narrow instep, but I wear orthotics, which makes me have a, you know, a high, like I have like a flat, narrow instep, but then I have a, suddenly I have a wide, high arch.
You're like more than leveled out.
Right. So I always have to size up. Anyways, but having said that, yeah, I had quality control issues with those boots anyway. And in fact, although this isn't a great sell for them, I'm selling a couple of pair because I'm sending a whole bunch of stuff off to this place where I've sold through before. And I just made a new pile and I was like, you know, do I sell these or do I not sell them? And, you know, and whatever. Anyway.
What is that, market or something? Market?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Whatever. Anyway, that one of the issues is like, well, there's a really specific thing with the jawed pores, which is that they don't stay. There's like a big gaping hole if you don't have the boots completely pulled up and cinched in just the right way. And there's a big bubbly kind of gap there where anything could get in there. I mean, not to mention it doesn't look good, but like, you know, whatever, water, snow, dirt, a stick.
Like a Skittle.
Yeah, whatever. You know, I actually brought that to his attention. Like, oh, well, you just need to tie the, but it, you know, it's like if you tie the top of a paper bag as tight as you possibly can, it doesn't mean it's not going to expand. You know, it doesn't, it doesn't work all the way down. Anyway.
Or lunch.
Yeah, I felt a little weird about it in the beginning. And then I was like, well, it's just been so, but then, you know, Clinch, Brass Tokyo, whatever, you know, became a kind of a little more accessible. I sort of feel like my sense is that in maybe some weird way, it encouraged him to be a little bit less mercurial. And in that regard, you know, maybe it was kind of a good thing because it seems like, you know, now there's all these like, you know, MTO events and things like that that he wasn't necessarily doing before, at least in the outside of Japan.
Yeah, no, I at Standard and Strange last October, yeah, I got to meet Minoru and like hang out with him and
yeah, me too, yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. It was pretty special and his pants were like huge and wonderful.
Yeah, well those are his line of clothing. I've stopped short of buying his clothing, but pretty much everything else he makes I buy.
Wait, so how often do you I'm running over here. Like we usually do like an intro, which I do an intro.
It's your thing. I mean, you know, whatever you need to do, you
can
do
all right, it. Here we go, everybody, in the middle of this. It's Adam Goldberg, photographer, musician, producer, director, actor, who stars in all my favorite stuff.
Oh.
From Saving Private Ryan to the Fargo TV series, Days of Confused. And he always looks good in them, you know, I mean, beautiful man, but well attired, appropriately. And person who happens to be ever so slightly afflicted by boots and Johns. This is him. All right, this one, I was going to drop this one off the bat, so I still kind of will. I have to tell you about this powerful connection between us, Adam. Very, very powerful.
What is that?
I went to the same high school as Christine Harnos.
Oh, I believe, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Had about four lines in Dazed.
Well, no, there were two parts everyone auditioned for. One, the men auditioned for Pink and the women auditioned for Chrissy's part. But then the way that everything was kind of edited in the end, yeah, the females in general got cut way down, which is, make of that, you know, what you will. But yeah, she was sort of the main lady, at least in the script. But yeah,
I guess somewhat fittingly, maybe like her core lines were, I think they're in the bathroom maybe, and she's talking about Gilligan's Island being a male pornographic fantasy,
right? Yeah,
but then they cut all the rest of her stuff.
Yeah, they cut a lot of stuff.
And then at the end, she has the classic, let's go smoke that joint line, which we quoted a lot in high school. I actually went through it the other day. For some reason, I got onto a text chain with my buddies.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about the most famous people from our high schools. And she's like, she's probably like number five.
Wait, where was that?
Harbor Fields High School, magical Long Island, New York.
Oh, right. I forgot where she was from. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody else is like a bunch of lacrosse players nobody cares about. And Mariah Carey. So we've got Mariah. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. What more does he need? I mean,
it was very upsetting actually because, shoe journalist that I am, I was, editor of the school paper, big brag here.
Uh-huh.
The year after I was a freshman in college and she came back and did this like big MTV concert at the school.
Oh.
It was like a 2-hour thing, right? They're on the football field, they're in the gym, like everybody's going. My sister was, you know, in a couple shots. And the editor of the Harbinger which was the name of our paper, which is actually fairly clever.
Yeah.
Not something I came up with.
Right.
You know, got to have like a sit down with Mariah, and I was sitting there, you know, just like smashing beer cans into the floor that Jen Lynch got that opportunity.
Oh man.
Instead of myself. So everything's timing.
Jen.
Poor Jen. Anyway, man. Yeah, Dazed is like to talk some movies for at least a little bit. I didn't see, I feel like I was like a little late, but I mean, only by a couple of years at that point. But I first saw it between my junior and senior year of high school. And I rented it at like the little store up the street. You got to give it back in a couple of days. So I watched it 5 times in one day over that summer. 5 times. I think by myself. I was just like, got to do it again.
Yeah.
And then we made fucking like wooden paddles.
I don't think that was supposed to be the takeaway, but yeah.
In my dad's basement. I don't think we paddled anybody. I'm pretty sure.
Hopefully just paddle Dennis.
But it seemed like the right thing to do. Yeah, yeah.
I think we should just discuss the shoes I wore in every role.
Well, I want to do that. Can we do that?
Sure, let's see. I wore my own steel-toe boots in that and my own Dickies. And then they provided the flannel. But the t-shirt, I believe, was mine. And I kept the belt buckle. But I've lost it since.
So did everybody?
No, I've just always been like that. I'm always like rationalizing. Like, this guy would wear Levi 517 polyester pants. I've said that in about 6 different roles. I'm like, I'm sure he would wear those just because I wanted to. And in that case, yeah, I mean, there was really no real explanation for it. I mean, I tried to get out of that wig, but that they really did force on me. That's basically how I dressed at the time, minus the wig. I even tried to wear in fact, I wore the same hat that Rory, you know, plays Slater, wears in the movie. He's wearing a hat wig, but that hat, he wore to his audition and I wore to my audition, but he got to wear it in his role and I got to not wear it in my role because he was like the cool guy and I was, you know, the dorky guy with the long hair, but
still stings.
Yeah, no, it does. But they, for whatever reason, yeah, they let me wear my Dickies and these steel toe lace up boots, which must have been what I assume that must have been what I was wearing at the time. I used to do most of my shopping at the California Surplus Mart, which is still there. It's on Vine Street and Santa Monica Boulevard and Hollywood or Los Angeles or whatever. So yeah, pretty much everything I bought was, at least at the time, I was wearing largely like, well, I used to just basically wear vintage clothing and but actual workwear, you know, from the California Surplus Mart. Not pretend workwear from Japan that costs 7 times that much.
Somebody had worked in it.
Somebody was working in it. But yeah, I mean, this was in the early 90s. It was all about Dickies, you know, so.
I mean, you said that you wore stuff of your, you know, these pants or whatever in various roles. Like, is that common? You know, because there's this like whole Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones story, right? He's like, I'm a carpenter and these are my carpenter boots and I'm going to wear them. And it's,
oh, is that right?
Vaguely verified. And then like now they're these Alden Indy boots, right?
I don't know. You know, there was this thing where De Niro always, De Niro's purported to have said that, you know, you don't know who the character is until you try the shoes on. He didn't mean figuratively. He meant he literally started like with the shoes. And it's ironic because it's the last thing that you see. I mean, especially in the TV show I do now, it's like, I'm sure you never see what I'm wearing. And I'm just fucking uncomfortable and squeezed into boots that are made for a man with half my width. You know, there's probably something to that, you know, whether it's like how you walk or your gait, or there's just something about starting from the literal ground up with a character. But in terms of like kind of justifying like what you want to wear, it's like, yeah, I would always push things sort of towards what I actually wanted to be seen in. Now, there's certain things you don't have much of a choice in the matter of. I mean, that is a period piece, but it was a period piece where you could get away with kind of a lot because it was the 70s. But if it was Beautiful Mind, obviously, I was like, whatever the hell they were going to put me in, Saving Private Ryan. I didn't have any say, except I did decide people could wear that tank hat or not, or whatever those are called. I forget. Those little wool caps with the bills on it. And you know, I chose to wear that and I chose to have a mustache. And that was about as much latitude as I had in that. You know, there was a part of me that probably wanted to be an actor very early on because I wanted to express some part of myself rather than, you know, be somebody who totally disappeared into some other, you know, role, some kind of fusion of the two of them, you know, some over-idealized version of myself.
Well, I mean, I think you've done a very good job of that, right? Like we're talking right now and you are a recognizable person from all the stuff that I've seen you in.
Perhaps.
Vaguely. Yeah. Thank you for trying.
Yeah.
Are you acting right now, Adam? Is that
I'm always acting. This is? Yes, I'm always acting. Yes. Well, fortunately, we all are. You know, some people are getting paid for it and some people aren't. You know, it's like everybody's a filmmaker when they dream, right? It's just that some people decide to write it down and then, you know, pitch it.
I was a weird filmmaker last night. I can tell you that much.
Well, there you go.
Okay, wait. So you mentioned Saving Private Ryan. What do you remember from that footwear wise? And like, obviously,
well,
like
the footwear wise, they like had to, we had dressers, you know, it was very British. We were, because they're, I'm so insane if you think about the guys who were actually in World War II. It's embarrassing. But anyway, they had to, you know, it was these really complicated, what do you call them? They're not, the boots were, you know, army, you know, whatever, boots, lace-up boots. But the things, what do you call those things? I can't remember now. You put them over your pants, you know, and over the top of your boots. So you're not getting, you know, you're kind of weather protecting yourself and keeping your pants from flapping around. And it was this big lace-up process. And I guess depending on the amount of time we had to get ready on certain days, you know, I think sometimes we would get some help from the wardrobe people. But yeah, the boots were combat boots. I know I kept a bunch of shit. It's just that I think it's all in a storage facility from the late 90s somewhere. And I lost track of things. Like I have a helmet with everybody's signature on it. And fuck if I know where that is, which is really awful. I mean, I know it's in a storage facility, but it'll be like, you know, I die and my family has to go through seven storage facilities and discover my totally intact apartment from 1996 or seven or whenever it was.
But somebody could get it on Storage Wars. Like there's a lot of possibilities here. Yeah.
Except that I guess I technically pay for it still. It's just that I've sort of lost track of how that billing works. Because when I was younger and I was living in apartments, pretty much anytime I did a job, not anytime, but it happened a few times. In fact, when I went to do Dazed and Confused, I moved out of my apartment. I living in a one room apartment. And I remember the last time I ever saw that apartment was the morning I went to the airport, because I was at my girlfriend's house and we went over and I picked up the very last thing. And then she drove me to the airport. And
well, that part's nice.
And then, yeah. And then I left and came back and lived with her for a while and got my own place. But anyway, the point is that I did this several times where I would leave to go do a job. Saving Private Ryan was another one. Came back, found another place to live. And each time I would do it in a hurry because, you know, acting's weird. And one day you're unemployed, the next day you're going to England or whatever. So I, you know, would just throw everything into trash bags and put them into storage facilities and then come back and start over, but oftentimes leave the shit in the storage facilities. So there's all these iterations of my lives between jobs for, geez, I don't know, for years and years.
All just sitting in storage bags as a disguise.
Yeah. In fact, you know, including trash, like they're just, I didn't have enough time to clean properly. And there's like receipts and I mean, you know, but there is one apartment, this apartment I lived in for 3 years on Rossmore and in a place in LA. And that was the longest for a long time until I lived, you know, in my house where, you know, I eventually kind of settled down for a while. I lived there for 3 years and I moved that whole apartment sort of as is. I'm trying to remember why that happened exactly, but into storage. And so it's like the couch, the lamp, the side table, like it all exists as like some small apartment within a storage facility. And so if I ever wanted to go visit myself footloose and fancy free, miserable, but still only 25, so less miserable, then that would probably be a good opportunity for me to do that and have some sort of like Bergman-esque Wild Strawberries, like, you know, series of flashbacks where I could confront my younger self and, you know, tell him to fucking mellow out because things were only going to get worse.
Except for probably the shoes. Wait, so like what would we find in these various storage facilities footwear wise?
I don't know that, you know, the clothes I think probably came with. I don't think I ever really put, well, now I have clothes in storage, but that's from the last 10 or 20 years, not from back then. Back then, I just didn't have that many clothes.
Yeah, the Dickies.
Right. I had like a couple of pairs of Dickies, a couple of pairs of Levi's. I had like 9 white t-shirts and like the coolest jacket I owned for a very long time was a 1940s leather motorcycle jacket. Not a double.
Double rider.
Not a double rider. You know, just like a single zip that I wore until it quite literally just completely fell apart. And I had, you know, some vintage clothes and stuff like that. Anyway, but all that shit was it. It was a reasonable amount of clothes. In fact, my whole thing about like having way too much shit and way too many shoes and way too much clothes is really quite recent. And, you know, in the last few years. And so during that period, that's when I started putting a lot of stuff into storage that I couldn't quite feel like I could throw out. It was certainly wasn't worth anything really. And it wasn't, I guess, selfishly instead of donate. I mean, I'll donate a lot of shit, but the stuff I didn't donate, I just couldn't bring myself to get rid of because I had too much sentimental value. And so that stuff is cataloged in like, you know, in a storage facility, but it's not of any interest other, you know, except to me, like though having like way too many boots thing. That's the other thing about for many years, what I would, for geez, a million years, my only interest in boots was making, was trying to reproduce James Dean's boots that you see in all these photographs of him. I mean, if there was a through line here and anything of any real interest to this podcast in terms of my, you know, inclusion, it would be that, you know, from the time I was 19 until 41, I was trying to make these boots based on these really sketchy pictures of James Dean wearing these boots. They're not engineer boots, not the Rebel Without a Cause boots, but his everyday boots were these kind of like weird ropers that had like a kind of a wrinkly shaft, which is the name of my memoir. And
this is a family show.
Yeah. And I couldn't.
Oh, I'm seeing them right now.
Figure out what the fuck they were. And this is obviously way before the internet. Now, once the internet was up and running, you can find a couple things on some forums very recently, but I kind of don't care anymore. It's not that interesting of a story. I'm just trying to figure out.
Keep telling it. James Dean personal boots. I got them right here.
Yeah, but that's.
Yeah, they're like wrinkly ropers.
Right. Wrinkly ropers. So what I would do is I would go to all these vintage boot stores and I would, there was a place on La Brea for a long time. And then I think it moved to Beverly right across from Swinger's restaurant. It was a vintage boot outdoor place. And for years, that's just how I got my shoes. It's from these parking lots. And I would buy these vintage ropers. And nothing was ever, you could get the shape of it. It's not that complicated, but it was really important because the shape of that boot isn't this massive U-toe. It's not quite a roper. It has almost a loafer vibe. You could never tell whether or not it had a toe cap on it or whether it was just from him wrinkling it in a certain way so that it lined up right at the toe cap. I mean, this was always the controversy about the style of it. And then in terms of the upper, and then in terms of like the shaft, like I was like, is it because he just wore the shit out of them? And I'm not kidding you. I would take pictures of myself or I would look at myself in photographs and I would be like, the boot sticking out of the is making my jeans protrude. And like, that's not right. Like it moved with him. What the fuck is that? So I had read, because I had read everything there was to read about James Dean in the early 90s, that he had had boots made by a guy on Sunset Boulevard. And I didn't remember his name. And this is somewhat unrelated, but kind of related. So I was like, well, one day, you know, when I have a lot of money, I'm going to have boots made, right? And in the meantime, I'm going to buy these, you know, $50 boots or whatever from these parking lots. And so one day I was driving somebody's tiny borrowed car, my girlfriend at the time's tiny, I don't know, like hatchback, Hyundai or something. And I was driving up Laurel Canyon and it's very steep from the valley side before you go over the hill and back down into the city down Laurel Canyon. And I'm driving up and I see a car just fucking goes right out of its lane and is coming right at me. Like I'm about to die. This is it. And I'm 20 years old. And I turn hard to the left and the car screeches by me and I hear a huge slam and I'm stopped in the center lane and I put my brakes on and I see way behind me, this car has just crashed, you know, headlong into some other car and they're on the side of the road. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm about to fucking, you know, witness when I get out of the car, but I run down there. Everyone turns out to be fine. The guy's obviously been hit, is like screaming and blah, blah, blah. The guy who hits him is this old, like.
It's James Dean.
Well, it's Donald Turnipseed who killed James Dean. But that would be.
Motherfucker.
That would be the story. I wish this was a better story. Let's just pretend it was James Dean's bootmaker. It was a bootmaker, an Italian, I think. I can't remember. A man of some European descent who was much older, had like fucking fully lost control of his car. And he was a bootmaker on Sunset Boulevard. So I was just like, holy shit. So I said to him, I mean, I'm like, on the one hand, I'm like, you know, a witness to this accident and whatever. And then on the other hand, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I said, did you make James Dean's boots? And I think that
seems like a perfect time to ask this question.
Yeah, exactly. I think, well, everything had been sorted. And I think he said like something that was alluring enough. Like he said that maybe like back in the, I don't know. I'd be fully embellishing this if I said, well, you know, he had thinks that he may have done something, or back in the old days, they blah, blah, blah. But I never, and he gave me his card. That's all I remember. So he gave me his card, but it was so many years later till I could afford to get boots made. It just didn't matter. I mean, that card was long gone, but there was a place on Sunset Boulevard that was making boots. And we'll just table that story for a second. So in the interim, there's a famous boot repair shop in LA called Willie's Shoe Service. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So finally in the, yeah, it wasn't, I didn't have boots made until 2009 or something. And so I went there and and Willie was there and he was alive and kicking and blah, blah, blah. But Raul was the kind of guy who was really making the boots. Yes. I'm not really sure. I can't remember what the transition process was because Raul now runs the Willie's. So I would show all these pictures and I guess, I don't know, there was the internet then. So I don't know. I guess what I was printing out a bunch of pictures. I was showing, you know, old books and blah, blah, blah. And we were trying to make sense of it. And we got pretty close to like, you know, what the shape of the uppers was like, but still no one could ever figure out what was going on with this wrinkly shaft. And so I had a couple pairs of these boots and I just wore them into the ground. I mean, I wore them until you couldn't wear them anymore. And then a few years later, I went back and we made another pair. And this time I was like, let's make these with a toe cap. So we made these with a toe cap and they kind of look a little more similar. And
on a roper.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that it looks like on his boots that he's got a toe cap.
I'm looking at him right now. It's like an incredible, precise, probably crease.
Yeah. But do you see how they're really fitted? Like they're not, when you look at most. So cowboy boots are really fitted and narrow, and then ropers have this kind of wider thing, and I think the big part of it was is that the sole was also very slim. It, you know, it wasn't like an engineer boot sole, so it was a Western sole on a very fitted boot. And if you just were looking at it, you could almost imagine they were zipper boots or something like that. So then I had those made, wore those into the ground, and then at one point I was like, I'm going to go try this place on Sunset Boulevard. And I went in there and I asked them, I was like, did you guys ever make James? I think they made up some fakakta thing about like how in the 50s, they think they did. But it had changed owners, you know, but it was still the same space. And they did make a lot of celebrity boots. They made boots. They had them all on the wall, all these boots that they were making for like Hedwig and the Angry Inch. They were doing all these, you know, extravagant boots for shows and things like that. So they were a real kind of Hollywood, almost costume shop in a sense. And so I had him make me some boots, but they didn't fit well really. And so I ended up returning them and I kind of gave up on this. And I always had some engineer boots or something like that kind of on the side. And so then I just got really heavily into engineer boots. And the engineer boot thing was the gateway into this whole Japanese workwear repro world. That's what really fucked me up. But I do want to finish the James Dean story because there's a kind of an amazing conclusion to this. So on Instagram, of all places, there's the James Dean Museum has an Instagram page. And I saw somebody had heard, like through my, you know, Instagram stories or something, somebody had heard about or taken note of the fact that I was on this quest for many years. And they said, I think these are the boots. And at the James Dean Museum, in a display, are these insane boots that are clearly... It's clearly the upper, and they're these long, they look like fucking equestrian boots. They're super high. I reached out to the James Dean Museum. I said, can I see these? Can you take these out of the case? She's like, we can't, but Marcus Winslow is his famous cousin that's in all these pictures with James Dean when he's a little kid. And when James Dean went back and Dennis Stock took all these photos of James Dean back at his family ranch about a year before he died, there's all these pictures of Marcus Winslow at the Winslow farm and James Dean. And here's Marcus Winslow now, you know, 80 years old or whatever. It's Marcus Winslow sent through the James Dean Museum curator a picture of him holding James Dean's boot and showing me the bottoms, the sides, everything I'd always wanted to see. I cannot explain to you. I was like in a fugue state. I was like, I felt like I was floating. This was about 2 years ago. I didn't even know what to do. But the crazy thing is, I now knew where to get them because they were very specifically made from a place that insanely is still in business and makes fucking equestrian boots. So I go online and I mean, there they are. They look crazy because they're not worn in or whatever. And like, they're basically equestrian boots. They're insane. But I'm like, I have to fucking have these. And you can only have them made. You can't buy them. They're not, there's no stock, you know, and they're insanely expensive. You know, I don't know about how, I don't remember, but they were a lot. Well, the irony is when I cared the most, I'd never be able to afford them. And I was like, do I really need to do this? I decided I didn't. And now I'm also a little confused because now I've seen some other pictures where it looks like somehow some of the math isn't adding up between like certain timelines. And I think he had two boots and I've been conflating them and I've given the whole project up. But
no,
I solved one of the pieces. And or at least this person who reached out to me and DM'd me solved one of the pieces. And I believe I wrote them back. Yeah, we can table that for now. But it's been a long journey. And at some point, like I said, I kind of gave in and then went the engineer boot route. And I'm kind of working my way back to Ropers with a burning love inside. I'm working my way back to Ropers.
That was the original cut.
Yeah, and I just had some great ones made by Zeros.
Oh, nice.
Really great. Some of the best I've ever owned. Amazing.
Like fit-wise?
Kind of shockingly fit-wise. Like they, you know, they kind of, you know, they do guesstimates. I mean, you're dealing with Instagram DMs, you know, so it's like.
Yeah, dude, it's tough.
Shockingly. What I noticed is that on my right foot, my little toes keep hitting the sides of it. But I started to realize something. They're doing that in all my boots. And I said to my wife, I think my right foot is, because it's happening in every shoe I own. Every shoe.
Like stuff that used to fit.
I think maybe my orthotics are getting wonky. And so they might be tilting me to the right more. Because that's what they do, is they keep me from pronating. And so they actually they tilt your foot slightly so that you're forming kind of more of like a V. I'm showing you, but.
If you don't wear them, are you just like grinding through heels?
No. And that's the thing. It's like, it's a little bit like being a member of a cult. I've had orthotics off and on since I was a kid. And I had really bad bunions, not from obviously ballet dancing, just I was born that way. And so when I was 30, I got double bunion surgery and they were really bad. And the right one healed amazingly well. And the left one was a little bit more prophylactically done so that I wouldn't get really arthritic like the right one was. And ironically, it's totally arthritic now because it healed poorly. And so the left one always hurts, the right one never hurts. But, you know, I've always been dealing with like the shape of my foot somehow. It's just always been a problem. Well, then I started to see the physical therapist because I started to get really bad neck and shoulder and spinal issues. And so I have degenerative disc disease. And so whatever, it sounds horrifying.
That sounds great. Yeah,
I know, but it's you know, it's like you have arthritis in your C spine, and so you know, I get a lot of pain in my neck and shoulders, and it refers out through my arm and blah blah blah. And I went to a guy who's like, it's all begins with your feet. It's all about your feet. It starts with your feet, and it's true. If you're standing funny, if you pronate like I do, my poor fucking 9-year-old boy already does. You know, your posture is weird. You know, I'm convinced I'd be like 6'1" if my shoulders incredibly hunched. My, you know, if you look at pictures of me, I look like early man, you know, when I'm walking.
With better boots.
But the truth of it is, without the orthotics, no, I do it all the time because there are certain boots that just absolutely won't work with, like the recent Clinch Westerns. And I can walk around all day like that. I think the thing is, if you stand a lot, it's important. If you're moving a lot, I think it's actually less important.
Interesting. I've never worn orthotics. I don't, you know, not believe in them or anything. Yeah, I mean, I have, you know, kind of in some ways bizarrely normal feet, which is nice for me, but then like it also just kind of, it provides a good baseline. I'm like getting DM'd all the time for like, how's this fit?
Yeah.
And that helps me understand it. But like, I mean, you're going back, you're like, oh yeah, my right toe is like rubbing and like you have degenerative right toe disease now. But like, you realize stuff over time, right? Like you're like, I know exactly like how this stuff fits and this lasts. And like, I'm out there, you know, like helping other people. And then like, I've been doing this for almost 5 years, you know, with this whole stitch down thing. I think every week, certainly every month, you realize that like you were just wrong or you didn't recognize something or you cared too much about this pair that it didn't matter to you or you didn't realize that something was wrong because I don't know, experience or whatever. Every fucking day you basically wake up and you're like, shit, man, feet are weird. And
well, yeah. And the way you hold yourself, it almost doesn't matter what it's like when you're sitting down and you put on a pair of shoes. Is kind of not almost, it's about 50% of it. The rest of it is like, it's like when you get a pair of jeans and like, oh, they fit great. I realize this a lot at the job I'm doing now because I play this fucking hacker and I'm just sitting all the time. And like yesterday, like I'm wearing these jeans where like the rise is kind of normal actually, but sitting down all day, I'm like, Jesus Christ, these are real, you know, nut scrunchers. You know, I don't wear like low rise jeans, but it's just like when you spend all fucking day, 12 hours sitting in front of a computer pretending to type, I guess I'm, you know, you have to get typing jeans, you know? It's like,
dude, finally, we figured out the $1 billion business venture here.
Typing jeans.
Typing jeans. Think about how many people are typing right now.
Exactly. Instead of dad jeans or whatever, mom jeans, typing jeans. Actually, typing jeans are 888 iron hearts for me because the rise is obscenely high and, you know, they're reasonably straight. They're not too, because what I don't like is that insane taper all the kids like.
Yeah, crunching nuts. James Dean boots. We're getting places here. It's Nick's Boots' 60th anniversary this year. 60 years! So first, let's just take a second to revel in 6 decades of the Spokane brand making some of the best, most deliciously indestructible boots in the entire world. Hey, nice job. Great revel. So what's up for 60? Well, for starters, new leathers, including Horween's wildly water-resistant yet absolutely beautiful Shackleton tannage, which you can apply to more boot-style options, sizes, and widths than literally anyone on the market. Also, new boot models, some built fresh from the ground up. I can't really reveal just now, but trust me, you'll love them. And one employee-designed boot each month of Nick's Big 6-0. New wedge soles to accommodate larger and wider sizing. Yes, wedge soles rule. I personally insisted on this development being in here. Maybe a collaboration with us over here at Stitchdown? Finally? We're working on it, all right? We're working on it. We're working on it. And of course, everything is built with a time-honored construction coupled with some of the best customer service in the whole game. Point is, I'd strongly recommend paying attention to everything Nick's is going to throw at 60. Check out their YouTube channel and sign up for their newsletter at nicksboots.com. And now, back to the ShoeCast. You taped a couple podcasts when, I don't know, I guess everybody was like, time to tape a podcast to forget about the horrors of the world in kind of like thick pandemic times, which I've listened to, the Ironcast, and I think the Blammo one seemed to be like quite early. Like everybody was very confused about what to do.
Yes, I remember that.
And you were like kind of seeming to be doing what a lot of people in this little world were doing too. And I think you actually said it on the podcast, like, well, we weren't going out to dinner, so I just kept buying shit. And what was happening then?
I remember when it started, there was a lot of things I was worried about when the pandemic started. But one of them was, I remember very distinctly saying, I'm either going to stop buying shit and it's going to be really healthy, or I'm deep shit and that's all I'm going to do, you know, depending on how long this lasts. And rational thing would be like, I don't have anywhere to go, so there's no reason to buy anything. And, you know, the thing about living in LA, where, although I'm not living there now, that's, you know, where I live, or where we say we live, really, we, I guess we don't anymore. But anyway, the point is that, you know, you had like, you have stores you can actually go to, you know, you have Self Edge or whatever. So I was like, well, I'm not going to Self Edge, you know, I'm not going to, but anyway, whatever. Well, yeah, what I did was as I'm sure many people did was I started ordering. I mean, I believe it was a banjo. I mean, that's not that weird because I play music, but I never played banjo. I just remember thinking that was peak pandemic for me.
It's like, do you watch Tiger King or do you buy a fucking
banjo? Right, right, exactly. And I got really, really heavy into switchblades.
Like swinging them around and stuff?
Well, I just buying lots of different automatic OTF out the front knife. Part of my rationale was that things were really sketchy.
I was thinking butterfly. I'm not a knife guy. I confuse butterfly knives with switchblades. I apologize.
Well, there's a butterfly knife, which I actually did buy, and I did cut myself immediately on it. Because when I was in my 20s, I used to have one, and I thought I was pretty good at it. But apparently, that's not a skill like riding a bicycle. And I did cut myself.
Muscle forgetfulness.
Yeah. But no, just like, you know, just knives that, automatic knives that, you know, not flippers, ones that you press a button basically and they come out the front. And so I didn't realize what a big, wide, wonderful world there was of knives you could have shipped to Los Angeles. So that was a weird, preoccupation. And I guess I was sort of justifying it because I was like kind of prepping for the apocalypse, which sort of felt like it was occurring in our neighborhood a little bit in a less abstract way than maybe some others. And then, yeah, ordering all kinds of fucking shit and then just taking like, you know, this in general is the problem is you start to realize, it goes way beyond clothes. It goes sort of with everything now, you know, which is that, are you doing something or are you buying something for performative reasons? And so that you can essentially, you know, catalog it and exhibit it and display it and post it. And, you know, are you really living that life or are you living as if you were living that life? I mean, you know, it begs a lot of those questions, but clothes to me are certainly one of the symptoms of that, which is kind of too bad because clothes are also fantastic and can be a really great way of, you know, expressing yourself. But like with everything, like, you know, right now I'm having this problem with music gear. I justify it because I'm like recording again for the first time in many years. I didn't have any of the stuff I left in LA because I'm out here. We've been out here in New York working for the last few years. But, you know, it's what it, you know, gas. Like, I mean, there's a word for it, gear acquisition syndrome. And I'm sure there's an equivalent acronym for clothes. I don't know, CAS, boots, bass. Oh, that's not bad. Bass.
Getting somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Bass, Weegians. Yeah. I mean, we're all desperately trying to like fill a hole and conceal a hole or, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's crack this the fuck open. The banjo or, you know, musical equipment. Like, you are a musician. You record music. You put it out there into the world. Like, there's your justification. Sure. Right.
But you can also, well, yeah. I mean, like, for instance, in this instance, I was like, hey, this is interesting because I have a very limited amount of stuff where I am. I'm going to get one thing that I know that I need. It's I'm gonna get a small synthesizer. And then suddenly I went headlong into the world of modular synthesis, which I had never really understood, even dipped my toe into or whatever. And now I'm like building a modular synth. It's just endless. You know, it's just fucking endless. I kind of feel like I might have hit a wall finally with clothes. And I really hope I have, because it also just seems where I'm, as they say, shopping in my closet. Like, and I turned my closet space that I have. I mean, I organized it in a way that it has never been organized before. I went label maker crazy, labeling everything from three-quarter, you know, there's a box of three-quarter t-shirts. There's a box of heavy-duty t-shirts, a box of, you know, whatever. and it's all labeled. And it's more like, I have a store. I can stop. There's nothing that I need. And nothing even that aesthetically I need in terms, even if I was to be like, because a lot of the stuff I keep because I might wear it on the show, I dress myself on the show. It started out as a collaboration and now I just fully dress. I mean, I tell them what I'm going to wear and they approve it or they don't, but down to my socks. And so I kind of feel like, all right, well, keep something that's a little bit weird and that you wouldn't normally wear because, you know, this character on the show, you can have him wear it or whatever. But I do feel like at a certain point, you know, it becomes gluttonous. Like, you start to feel like, you know, like sugar sick and also kind of guilty, you know, just because Jesus Christ, you know, people are starving and, you know, don't have clothes. But there you go.
To keep going, I'm always trying to figure out the why in this particular category, right? Like, I do this thing. Part of it is, hey, if you're looking to buy a pair of boots, we can help you.
Yeah.
There's all these different things that you need to understand or don't need to understand. But if you want, let's go ahead and open that door and it can actually be fascinating, like inherently on its own without like separated from the objects, essentially. Like I've tried to get a couple of pairs of cowboy boots because stylistically, like, I don't know, maybe it would be me, maybe not. But the way that they're built, right? Like the construction and the wood pegs and, you know, kind of the beauty of these old lasts and, like, they're just fascinating and interesting.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
To learn about, you can apply that to all different kinds of construction, and leather becomes engrossing in certain ways, and just like shoe lasts, like what you like and how it fits, but also, you know, historical relevance and all this. So there's this, and you can learn about that, and you can, you know, I'll tell somebody like kind of what I do for a living. And at first, either they'll get it right away and they'll be like, okay, what boot should I buy? Or I've been looking for a pair of boots because I have feet. Or they give you like a very, very odd look. And then you're like, all right, I got about 90 more seconds to like hook this person into understanding why anybody would care about this so much, divorced from like pure function, right? And usually I get them. Usually the eyebrows raise like, oh, okay, yeah. Like, people do care and I'm starting to see why. And then there's this like acquisition piece, right? And like, you know, we participate in that too. And we have roundups and, you know, never being like, you need these things, but if you want some, you know, we can be helpful. And, you know, for this whole industry to continue to work, people kind of need to buy shit so people can make it. That's how things function. You know, there's something about this category that it can just run away with you and you're beginning to use all those things I just mentioned about like history and beauty and shape and, you know, relevance as a justification to just like buy some new shit. And you can apply that to knives. You can apply it to whatever.
I will admit that when I go outside and I see a package and I look at the label and it's to my wife, my kids, or my dog, I feel a fucking letdown. Like I'm sad. And that's just fucked up. I mean,
even if it's from Amazon.
Yeah. Oh, if it's from Amazon.
You get something? It's like, why do you get 18 rolls of scotch tape? Yeah.
Right.
This isn't fair.
And I do think the pandemic contributed to that quite a bit. And I'm worried for my kids about it because, I mean, they're back into the world for sure. But there was a sense for a long time. Well, my one-year-old, well, he's five years old, but he was one at the time. He didn't know. He didn't have any memory. You don't really have any memory until you're older. So he didn't have any memory at one of what a supermarket was. So I remember this one car ride with my son, Bud, who at the time was five. So he was five and Sonny was one, explaining to Sonny what the joys of a supermarket. Now, again, Sonny had been in supermarkets. He'd been in the cart and the whole thing. He just didn't remember it. And Bud would tell him, there's this place where you can go and you can get samples of food.
Oh, that's a good one.
And we were hardcore pandemic people. Like, you know, we really were draconian about it. And so we just didn't go fucking anywhere for a very long time. Restaurants, whatever. So the world was delivered. And for Sonny, it's fucked him up because when we order something and it doesn't come within 35 seconds, he's like freaked out about it. The older one had, you know, was already, he knew that you got on a plane and you flew to Toronto and you went to the magic shop and you bought a magic trick and then you went on the train and you came back to your apartment. Sonny was, the world was delivered to him and you didn't go anywhere, you know, for a while. And I don't know how much or little that has affected his, you know, sort of ability to be kind of just patient and exploratory and all these other things, which seem to be sort of rearing their heads now that he's five. But I mean, I remember in the really, really early days of the internet, I was like, this is really fucking cool because eBay was still like, whoa, I could get like a 1966 Framus 12-string guitar. Like, that's fucking insane. That's so wild. That's just so cool. It's like going to a vintage shop in, you know, in Iowa or whatever, or wherever I don't have to drive to or whatever. And there wasn't that many of them, you know. Now you can just get anything from anywhere. It doesn't matter how fucking rare it is. It definitely takes some. I mean, I love being an old man for this reason alone. But like long before Karen Dalton was really cool, she had made two records, but one record was the, you know, famous one. Remember the name? You know Karen Dalton, right?
I'm not a big head.
Okay. But. All right. So Karen Dalton, especially in the early 2000s, like somebody had played her for me and it blew my mind. She was a folkie from Oklahoma who moved to New York in the 60s and hung out with Bob Dylan and stuff, but she had only made two records. She was incredibly sort of shy and didn't want to record. And Fred Neil, who was Greenwich Village folkie, like got her to record this one record. And then she did one with a bunch of session guys, but she sounded exactly like Billie Holiday, but she was this kind of white, you know, not black woman, but sounds exactly like Billie Holiday. And I got into this record and it was literally a record. I mean, that's all that existed of it at the time. This was before an iPod existed. So this was like, it was right after 9/11. I'd broken up. My girlfriend and I had broken up. I was in deep, just like mourning for pretty much everything. And someone had played this record for me in New York in their little shop, like downstairs somewhere in the dead of winter. And I was so fucking moved by it. And there was this great record shop I lived near in New York, Other Music. But nobody had this record. You couldn't fucking find it anywhere at any of the cool record stores, Kim's, any of these places. And then I was bopping back and forth to LA at the time. And so I would go to LA and I would go to Amoeba and I couldn't find it anywhere and couldn't find it anywhere and couldn't find it. Anyway, what's my point? My point is like you actually had to look for something. And of course, now you can stream Karen Dalton. It's like no problem. And that's great because Jesus Christ, you can get off this call. And if you're interested, you can go listen to Two Caring Dalton Records without having to break your back.
Plan to.
So, you know, or someone making a tape. In fact, that's how I got clued into a lot of really amazing music was my friend John Tottenham, who is a really eccentric and interesting and brilliant, weird poet who I've known since our Book Soup days when we were working at Book Soup in the early 90s. He would make all these tapes for me of these kind of folkies who'd sort of fallen off the radar and 70s musicians and stuff like that. And that's how I would hear music was through these cassette tapes he would make. But my point is it's way too easy. And so when I started to get into like the engineer boot thing, and one thing led to another, and I discovered at the time I was in New York that the Real McCoys had a shop in Soho next to Blue and Green, I went into that store and I was like, wait a minute. So you're telling me that like all the like Western gear that I had been like hunting for at all these vintage stores all these years. You know, I remember again, way back in the 90s, there was this vintage shop in New York. I can't remember the name of it, but they had all this crazy dead stock Wrangler and shit like that. And so you're telling me that all this stuff is like now just like reproduced like to the stitch. And yeah, it costs $300, but I could just buy whatever I want. And whatever I had ever imagined, essentially, except maybe these James Dean boots, that's amazing. And for a while, it was limited to the fact that I was in New York and I would just go hit up the Real McCoys all the time. I was like, oh my God, it's the perfect sweatshirt. Holy shit. It's the perfect pair of jeans. They're better than, you know, I don't have to go to the Levi's store anymore and wear like, you know, I was like wearing a lot of 517s because I was like into boot cuts and boots and shit. And it's funny because I used to pride myself on the fact that my entire wardrobe costed about, you know, $100 except for my shoes. That was the only thing I spent a lot of money on. And now I can't pride myself on any of that. I mean, this mock turtleneck I'm wearing costs more than what an entire outfit, you know, cost me not more than 10 years ago. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Real McCoy's, it's a brick and mortar store. Okay, fine. But then, of course, the internet is infinite. And, you know, then I discovered the From Japan website and then all bets were off. Might as well have just been in Japan.
It's too easy now, right? Again, we're all sitting at home a few years back and trying to get the little burst of happiness and like, you know, one up our wife and kids with package deliveries. But yeah, man, like back in the day, I mean, you're, I don't know, maybe a decade older than me or something. Like I was born in 81. So I, right on the periphery of the internet, I didn't have high speed internet until I got to college. I was like, holy shit, we can really download these Fish singing Gin and Juice wasn't Fish on Napster like so easily. Isn't this great? It doesn't, you know, take 8 minutes for a picture to upload. And you had to like put in the work, right? Like I wouldn't be doing this if I wasn't, you know, an enthusiast about something or a bunch of things at like basically all points in my life. Yeah, I mean, it was like magazines, right? Like, God, were magazines great back in the day for figuring out anything, like stuff about cars, sports, baseball cards, right? Like I have like in my little workshop down here, I have like all my parents just moved recently. So I got all the remaining kind of baseball cards. And you're like, you knew everything about this player, pitcher, just from flipping the card over, and you could understand them completely, but you had to do it and you couldn't ask for it. Like you had to go either find it or it would come to you. You couldn't
ask Alexa.
No, I mean, like you couldn't just type something in. And, you know, there was something to that. Like my first car that I ever bought was this Volkswagen Corrado. It's like this completely obscure Volkswagen they made for 5 years. And I saw one driving down the street and I was like, whoa, what is that? That's cool. Cause there's like 5,000 of them at that point. Somehow it actually ended up being kind of like the early internet that took forever to load. And finally the picture comes up. You're like, yes, that's it. And you find this forum of people that were into this thing. This is like early Volkswagen forum in like 97, probably. It was wonderful. You're like, wow, I can learn things from. I just bought a car from one of them and like they have parts and they're sharing this, but it was like 60 people.
No, I know.
And it wasn't immediate. Like,
it's funny. I still have, I think, saved on my bookmarks, which is so funny because I've changed. I don't know. I guess it doesn't matter how many times you change your computer as long as you stay like in the same system. But yeah, I have like mercurymarauder.net. I mean, wasn't that long ago, but it was 2005 that I had a Mercury Marauder and I was like looking for ways of souping it up. And I was in this forum, whatever, but no, I used to buy old cars and motorcycles and things like that, you know, from Auto Trader and Cycle Trader when they were just newspapers. It's just so crazy.
Yeah. Just like combing through classifieds and then trying to make some sort of connection.
I used to have to buy dirty magazines at the magazine stand. Do you understand that?
You know, you had to do it face to face.
Yeah.
You'd have to go in there. You'd have to, you know, get to, imagine if you were 6'1", you could get to the really good ones at the top.
The only way you had to just go there, pretend you were fucking buying, like,
pretend you're 18
GQ or whatever, and then go
put that one on top.
18. I think we're talking about when I'm like 30, but yeah. Okay.
And the shame you would feel purchasing this from some guy who pretty much sold exclusively dirty magazines to people. Like,
the flip side is that I could also buy cigarettes from cigarette machines, because those existed. So you could be 14 and go buy
those things that you would pull out, right?
There was a Fatburger I used to go to, and I would take my quarters and I would go walk up to the Fatburger in LA and San Vicente Boulevard or wherever it was. And kind of sneak in there and just be inconspicuous. And of course, the quarters go like ka-ching, 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 ka-ching. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe now there's a way to buy a bunch of cigarettes online, probably. But that would be the advantage. There was a smoking, I was telling my wife, at my high school, there was a fucking smoking bench. That's when I went to high school. And it wasn't just for like the science teacher, you know.
Apparently, Mariah spent a lot of time on the smoking bench, goes the Harbor Fields lore. Yeah.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, there's something about like the work and the weight that you can still get, right? Like, people will, just some person from the internet, be like, oh, this and that. And oh, well, I think that you would really like, right? And, oh, man, it seems like it's going to take like 9 months to, you know, get a pair of Knicks boots made. And it's like, yeah, I mean, like, they're making them and a bunch of other people want them. And, you know, they don't have enough bootmakers. And let me help you understand a little bit about this industry. Or, you know, like something from Brian out in L.A., where it's like 2 years. And it's like,
well, right. So yeah, I got him at the best time, because I got him kind of early on, like when I was trying to find the perfect engineer boot. And I found his, I feel like his website is still kind of beta, but I found his website.
And doesn't need
like,
it.
Yeah, right. And I was like, what are these? And I found some stuff on Instagram. He had just put them out, the first, you know, iteration of them. But he was in LA. I was in New York, but I was just working. So I was going to come back to LA. And I was like, you know, I'd love to come in for fitting. You know, so I did. And I was about to shoot this movie. And I was like, I would love to wear these in the movie. And I got them in like a normal amount of time. It was great. It was, you know, and I wore them in this film and whatever. But the point is, it was cool because I could just go to the shop. It was not an internet experience, you know. It was like the perfect integration of it. It was an internet introduction. And then I went there and it was a guy. And then I, you know, took a bunch of photos of him and I made some posts about him and sort of, you know, engaged with him, you know, from a kind of a creative point of view for me, you know, and that was super cool. Yeah, you know, what happens is like you hit all these like kind of grails and then you're kind of like, you know, I guess it's kind of like being, you know, like a super stud. I mean, at a certain point, you're Jack Nicholson or, you know, Wilt Chamberlain. It's probably the better example. Does it even like, does it even matter anymore? And I will tell you that dude, is it Graham's Boots?
Yeah, Graham Ebner in Austin.
Those are the only ones I want left. I mean, those are the only, that to me is the only thing left.
He's only getting better every time. He does just something.
I like how he's upfront about it. I make really expensive boots. And I was like, well, yeah, I get it. I mean, like, man, boots are expensive. And, you know, we don't all have that kind of money or whatever. But I'm like, you know, I'm working. You know, I can handle it. And then I go online and I look and I'm like, whoa, can't handle that. It's a lot of money.
He makes a great t-shirt too. I have a t-shirt.
What's it? Does it say that?
It says really nice, really expensive. And there's like a picture of a cowboy boot.
So they are insane. They're on to me, just like on a completely different level. I still would be curious to understand, because he is clearly, he's branding the expense. It's always hard to get your head around it. You know, once you're in the world or whatever. I mean, there's certain things where it's like, you're obviously just paying for the name VisVim, because there's no fucking difference between that t-shirt and that t-shirt. VisVim, I mean, I have a couple things, but I have a couple reasonably priced things or things I stole from, you know, the wardrobe department on my show or something like that. But like, there's no way you can rationalize that to me, you know? But with him, it's like he's making pure art. So I'm just curious, though, is that what he's charging for? Is the art itself or the actual labor intensity of that art?
To me, it's really straightforward. Like with, especially with Graham, I mean, many of the great Western bootmakers, because there's so much that you can do or you can't do in terms of the base fancy stitching, as the actual wonderfully hilarious term. And, you know, you're getting like a kind of custom last built in. So like that's cost right there. But the stuff that he does, or
I mean, we could say, like, look, we could say, okay, $2,000. But once you hit $2,000, I'm pretending I have any idea what he does. And then I would think, like, okay, what he does is so insanely unique and requires such an art, you know, and aesthetic sort of eye, and an artisan's ability to be able to execute that vision. Fine. And then the ultimate product is so unique and eye catching. Let's throw in another $1,000. Okay. So in my mind, I'm just up to $4,000. So then from there on, what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, you're like,
is it human leather?
Yeah. It's human leather. And like, you can't just get that from the internet. No,
I get that. I mean,
so we got the baseline stuff, right? You got your last and you got your time and stuff. But really, actually, that's what it is. It's time. Yeah. One, you have this unique person who can do certain things. There's many great Western boot makers who can do similar stuff, the inlay and overlay, which is what creates a lot of those beauty of it, right? And the uniqueness. But some of the work that he's doing, like, it's just one, something that he and very small handful of people can do, period. So you kind of got to pay for the person who can actually do it if that's what you want. And two, it's just time. So like 40 hours is generally for like a normal pair of, let's call them like 6-inch lace up boots with probably, maybe not even sometimes, a custom last, like 40 hours. It's like a week. It's kind of nice that that's the time frame that it fits in for like a skilled professional custom bootmaker to make something, because we all understand like what we make each week. And then you factor in the materials and all that. But, you know, as a baseline.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm completely overpaid. And I don't know what the algorithm and the math is that goes into paying people in the entertainment industry above the line and people in the entertainment industry. Like, it's weird because you get to a point where you're like, I'm not being paid enough. And then you start comparing it to, well, not only what other people make, but like what you're actually doing, which, you know, oftentimes, while labor intensive, is, you know, completely inane. You know, I can't 100% rationalize it, but everything is relative, right? So you know what you're paid according to this other person's, but you know what I mean? Like there's an internal logic, I guess, is what I'm saying. That's all I'm trying to understand. I hope that's not coming off as like, how the hell? Because I just was like, oh, okay. I have to ask the show if the show's on for, I literally said this, I go, if the show's on for 10 years, would you guys buy this, my character, these boots? And it's kind of a tacit understanding that whatever they buy, I'm going to steal because I contribute all my own clothing to the show.
Yeah, they don't know. It all gets lost in the mix. No. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. And I think it's actually really helpful for people to understand. But I think that the Big Bend boots that he did, which were the ones with like the aliens and the shrooms and like all this stuff, like very, very, you know, custom and personal, all that. I think it took him 120 hours he logged, like 100. So let's just now start to call that a month. The man needs a break. And he needs to acquire stuff and, you know, materials wise and like just the drawing that he does beforehand to get to it. That's time. So now let's say a month, and if it costs $5,000 and let's take out maybe $500 for materials, I mean, he's making $4,500 a month. Yeah. He's making 45 and it's selling a couple t-shirts.
Right.
Like making $4,500 a month as an incredibly skilled Western bootmaker. And you're like, fuck, man.
And it's not a hobby.
Can I pay you more? Yeah, he's got a shop. He's got rent, you know, electricity. Very poor internet. Actually, no, he doesn't have internet, which I learned because when we taped, he was like, yeah, this internet's terrible because the comedy club downstairs really needs to upgrade their internet. So he's saving some there. But yeah, when you think about it, like nobody, like not a single person who is like a specific one person custom bootmaker is like getting rich off of any of this. And for most people, like their brains can't necessarily process that because they hear the price and think that, you know, $300 is a ton of money for a pair of shoes.
And I'm always the person in the comments who's like, oh, I'm actually trying not to be the person in any comments anymore. Who's like,
you should comment more.
I comment. Who's like, you know, fuck off, you know, go to Marshall's or whatever. You know what I mean? So it's like, I that's why I want to clarify, you know, that I fully get it and I'm, you know, whatever. I like to think of myself as Mr. Slow Fashion, sometimes really slow. I mean, Jesus Christ, this watch band, 6 months. But I just wanted to understand. I mean, that makes complete sense to me. Anyway, those boots would be, I don't know that, you know, how well they would work with orthotics or not.
Well, it's custom. You could figure it out.
Those are an end game boot for me. I mean,
let's go to Austin and, because I want to do that. I want to go to Austin and then I think
oh, is that where he is?
like Fort Worth. Yeah, he's in Austin, which is kind of where he was living and where he trained under Lee Miller at Texas Traditions, which is like a bigger shop, and not everything is quite so, I mean, it's all custom, but maybe not quite as complicated with every single pair, which allows you to develop some level of scale and build this business. But again, like, nobody's getting fucking wealthy off of this. But I think Fort Worth is actually where there's like a row of cowboy boot shops, and there's everything from $150 boots to full custom, but like big shops. And yeah, I've never been in like any of those, and I kind of want to.
Yeah, I was always into Western boots, and then I basically seem to have taken a hiatus, but his definitely just sort of really piqued my interest. Sorry, you have a friend who what?
He's like a designer for Ariat. He lives in León, Mexico, where a ton of like they make all their stuff, and like most of the Western boots in the world are made, I think is pretty safe to say. So those are the two places I want to go. Because again, it's just like, I don't really think I'm going to start wearing them a ton personally, but there's just something so interesting about them. I'm in like an odd position, right? Because, you know, this is what I like do with my life, and I have to learn to like project that out. Just like the learning, like I kind of wear the same shoes most of the time.
You want to know what I've been wearing every day? You ready?
Hit me.
Here it comes. Blundstones.
There it is.
I look around and I'm like, I'm just so tired. I'm just like, everything hurts. I just like, and I live in, you know, the small town. Who am I trying to fucking impress? I just literally want to be comfortable, and I don't want my feet to get wet. And I will tell you something. They're the most comfortable shoes I've ever worn. I wore them on the TV show the other day, which to me was like a bridge too far, because I was just, but I'm like, you know, nobody's.
A hacker would never wear these.
Well, that's my joke, is that a hack, you know, is that like, I'm like, yes, so this hacker needs this capital denim shirt and these BISVIM socks, because, you know, he's hacking. But I was just like, I don't do much in this episode. I don't think you're going to see my feet. And it's just like the walk from my dressing room to the soundstage, up these stairs and everything. It's just long enough where I'm like,
we'll get you some Russell moccasins, which is more days than not. That's what I'm wearing.
I have like a
so comfortable.
Well, I actually have a lot of Zeros and Yucatan around slip-on things. That's like what I probably do wear the most, because I don't leave the house very often. But if I had the Graham boots, I would wear those around the house.
Yeah. I mean, you got to just be one with something like that.
Well, right? That's the other thing is, you know what the other thing is that we really became the people that where you had to take your shoes off by the door. And once we became those people.
Adam, it's been great having you on the podcast.
I should say my wife. I mean, once she starts, sends me articles about all this, you know, the fecal matter you pick up on your shoes and stuff like that. And I think a lot when our kids were crawling around or whatever. And then it really became like, why do I need more than slippers in this universe?
I'm building immunity over here.
There you go. Think of it that way. I guess that's good. Yeah. To all the fecal matter. Yeah. Our friend's a scientist, and she did some study on something about what was on the subway rails, or, you know, whatever the poles are that you hold.
Oh, I never touch those. Never touch. Oh,
no,
those.
Of course not. Of course not. But it's incredible. It's really as though people just spend their days with their hands up their asses, quite literally. Just that's what they do mainly with their hands.
It's what we have to do. It's kind of essential. So you've got kids,
mm-hmm.
two. I imagine you go and like drop them off and pick them up from school or activities, right? Like you're interfacing with like the rest of your local community. Live in the city for 15 years in New York, and you can wear whatever you want, and everybody's wearing whatever their version of like something cool is. Like they're probably trying to wear it, so like it's nobody's ever out of place. And it's great. I love it. Like, I love just going back in and just looking at everybody.
Yeah, I agree. I was driving through the city last night coming because I work in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, but then I drive all the way home to north of the city. And usually you skip the actual city and just take a bunch of bridges. But for whatever reason, the nav was having me go through the city, which was a fucking goddamn nightmare driving. But having said that, it's like incredible to me how interesting everybody is. They're just so cool in their own way. But anyway, yeah.
They're like a little more free.
Not where I live.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm like three.
I feel weird here, and that has something to do with the Blundstones. I think I was just like, just take it down a notch, dude.
That's it. Like how, and like you kind of have, you have a problem that I don't have where you are a recognizable individual.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it doesn't always feel that way. And so, I mean, it's not always that way. And I don't think it's not, it doesn't come up that often. But I mean, the truth of it is most of these people, you know, came up, you know, like moved from Brooklyn or moved from wherever. And they're like.
And they all stopped dressing cool.
Well, yeah. There's a little of that, but you know what's funny is that our best friends here, I met through eBay. And maybe this is
we all have that story.
Maybe this is a good note to go.
Let's get it here.
So I was selling one of my 79, and this is the other problem. I got eye surgery. I have terrible vision, and I've wore contacts my whole life, or glasses, mainly contacts. And I decided to finally get this eye surgery. It kind of worked enough to function basically, but not enough so that I can like read well or even drive that well. So I wear glasses now. Why not contacts? Because the whole point was to never wear contacts again, because it was becoming, because I didn't want to wear contacts anymore.
Yeah, but glasses can be cool too.
Well, right. Unfortunately, they become too cool and too expensive. So then I became a Jacques Marie Mage addict, and that's been a real problem. Anyway, I was selling a pair of these glasses. This guy on the internet or on eBay was hitting me up, and then he was like, you know, I live right near you. And he's like, why don't I just come pick him up or whatever? And so then we met, like, this was like kind of peak pandemic on my doorstep. It was real snowy, I remember, and it was like freezing or whatever. So I couldn't really tell, but I was like, oh, obviously he's got style. He's buying these glasses or whatever. But he kind of had this doppelganger-ish vibe with me. And then we're like, well, and they have two kids and they're exactly the same age as our kids. And we're like, why don't we go meet at the park? So then at some point we had a play date, and then my wife and his wife were like basically wearing the same clothes. And now it's to the point where they're both, my wife is like 5'11", and our friend Aaron is, I don't know what she is, but she's tall. She's like 5'9", and you can't tell from behind, like you got to be careful who's who. And then they bought, now of course, you know, and then they came really close friends, so they're wearing the exact same clothes. So, and then Daniel buys my clothes before I sell them, if he wants, like he comes over first. And so now he's literally wearing my clothes, and we coach baseball together, and we're sure, and this is kind of actually a show idea. Should 100% not be talking about this. So anyway, but it's been somewhat inspiring, this idea of like kind of living in a purple county, because that's where we live. Our town is very progressive, but our county, not so much. And so how it is that we kind of cohabit. So our like Little League is part of the much larger county Little League, you know, as opposed to just a tiny provincial town. Daniel were always like, you know what they're thinking, like, you know, bearded Jews with the faded jeans, you know, coaching Little League while these other guys are all like firemen and cops and shit like that. And like Daniel and I look like these twin. I mean, it's just, it's so, we have really cool friends who Roxanne grew up with, and they have the coolest shop, not just in town, but they're known. And it's just kind of a coincidence that they kind of grew up here and then they moved back here and now they run the shop. Let's just say that they're super cool. And so there's enough of that, but then you venture like just outside that area. And then, yeah, you feel like some kind of whatever, you know, Los Feliz asshole, which is essentially what we are. We're carpetbaggers, you know?
I'm trying to figure it out too. You know, like you wear this stuff, you buy this stuff, like for yourself and for all those other things that we talked about, but also because like, obviously there's something that you're trying to like give off, right? Like some kind of perception. And then you're like, fuck, what is this perception that I'm giving off now? And how far can I push it a little farther?
No, because there'll be a real cowboy who's going to come up and be like, so you want to go horseback riding? And you'll be like, what?
But you, at that point, you just have to say yes.
Yeah, you have to say yes. I mean, now the funny thing is our kids, well, for a while, were actually riding horses. So I was like, look, man, I'm gonna wear my Western boots to the ranch, you know? And I was riding a motorcycle here until I got run over by my neighbor, and now I will never get on another motorcycle again. And it was stupid because I have kids. But I mean, I was hit going 15 miles an hour by a fucking neighbor.
Fuck.
I wasn't off my block.
He's not buying your eBay stuff, is he?
She is not. So I was like, yeah, I am justified. And here's the funny thing about that. I have all these quote unquote motorcycle clothes, but do you think I wore any of them on the bike? No, I wore shit from that have like D30 ghost armor protection in them. And yeah, you can kind of find cool places like Jane Motorcycle, Butterscotch LB, like a couple of places that actually does cool shit that's actually protective, but none of that shit is really protective. Like none of the 50s stuff. I mean, James, it's better than wearing shorts. No. I mean, you wear a leather jacket and jeans, it's better than wearing shorts, but I was wearing full armor when I got hit, and I still had on my elbows and everything. And I still had, and it was, frankly, it was pretty goddamn cool. It was a Vanson jacket that they made, a wax canvas Vanson jacket, but they put armor in it. So you could find these workarounds, but would you actually wear your real McCoy engineer boots? I wasn't. I was wearing boots that had like 69 fucking, you know, buckles and pads and protectors and things that, you know, so you don't break your ankle, which I did, and I broke my wrist. There you go, because I was wearing gloves that were just a little too cool.
Better than your ankle. None of your boots would probably fit after that.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Look, man, I think you need some lunch. It's in your eyes.
I gotta go eat.
I don't know that we figured out anything today, but I'm really happy to have not figured anything out.
Yeah, you have to pose problems and then you let your public figure it out for you. Drop it in the comments below and remember to slam that like button and hit the bell. This is from someone who watches way too many tutorials.
Slam away, everybody. Adam, look, man, this is fucking great. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, man. Wrinkly shafts forever.
All right. Huge thanks to Nick's Boots for sponsoring this wonderfully rangy episode. Support the ShoeCast by treating yourself to a Stitch Down premium membership. Come hang out with a bunch of highly sane, poorly dressed people in our Discord. Just kidding, the opposite. And save that date for Stitch Down's Boot Camp 2 in Industry City, Brooklyn, October 12th and 13th, 2024. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.